BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the author Anne Enright. Irish culture and identity are rich veins in her work, along with family, sex, the body and motherhood. And these threads are part of a larger tapestry, exploring universal questions about human nature and exposing sometimes uncomfortable truths. In 2015, she became the inaugural laureate for Irish Fiction, the public face of her home country's literary life. They could hardly have picked a better candidate to represent the complexity of contemporary Ireland. Early on in her career, she decided that she could write about anything because, as she put it, nobody who considered themselves a keeper of the canon would hear it. It didn't quite work out that way. Her novel, The Gathering, won her the Booker Prize. She says, "The periphery has always been the more interesting place for me. I didn't quite fit, and that suited me. I never wanted to be mainstream as a writer, but look what's happened." Anne Enright, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
Your writing is often about change. Why is it so important to you to look forward in that way?
I can't tell you how much I hate conservative work and how how hard it is sometimes for people to spot that actually a lot of people are working in nostalgia, or they're chipping away making something that is almost dead. You know, I like the work to live. I like the work to be flawed. I like it to engage and put people off, even. I like it to be busy somehow.
You said that you have a talent for sentences. Tell me a little bit more about that.
I have certainly an interest in sentences and what they can do. The thing is, when you're writing, you're in there, and it's a bit like a black box. You can't get out. It's a state of flow, you know. You're following something and catching it at the same time. So that feeling of a gap that's been filled even as it opens is just brilliant to experience. Quite addictive. Very much what I go to when I need comfort. That's why I write. I write to shut the world away. I mean, I just love it. It's just great to have a space in your head where you go, where you're working something out.
When you took on your laureateship, you mentioned that you wanted to raise the issue of the gender imbalance in the canon. What needed to be said?
It was really moving to be somehow chosen. And I took on the gender thing with great reluctance because I wanted to be a writer, which was a very important thing to be, and not a woman, which was a slightly less important thing to be. But I thought, I'm going to say the things that need to be said. And much against my better judgment, I dug into the issue of gender and the canon. Ireland is so busy being Irish and being pleased with itself for being, you know, both lovely and lyrical and above all things Irish, that nobody paused to look at the astonishing gender imbalance there was within the reviewing culture, for example. And there was a huge amount of unconscious bias in the literary scene. The disparity that I found that was most interesting is that women are very happy to admire men, but men find it very difficult to admire women in return.
You spent 3 years with that as one of the key issues that you wanted to talk about. How much progress were you able to make, do you think?
Well, those 3 years coincided with an absolute explosion of wonderful literature by women, world-taking literature and books by women. Emma McBride, Sally Rooney, Anna Burns, 3 great female writers. So by the time I'd said it, there was no need to prove it. And the walls had all been tumbling down. So I was just part of that. And I was, in fact, just documenting it, not pushing them down at all.
And how does it feel to be part of that new wave? So many wonderful women's voices in Irish fiction.
It feels less lonely. Thank you for asking. When I say it feels less lonely, there always have been women's voices side by side all through my writing life. But to see them hit new heights has been salutary, fantastic.
It's time to go to the music and tell us about your first disc. Why have you chosen it?
I used to listen to Glenn Gould on a kind of a loop. playing the Goldberg Variations in the 1955 iconic recording. But after that had been, you know, happening in the room for a very long time, we would break in suddenly to this lovely Brahms intermezzo in E flat. And it was a moment when I lifted my head from the desk.
Part of Brahms' intermezzo in E-flat, played by Glenn Gould. Anne Enright, you were born in Dublin in 1962. Anyone who's read your work will know how brilliantly you write big families. So talk me through the dynamics of being the youngest of five.
I am the youngest of five, which is not like being the kind of middle of nine or 12. And actually, if there were less than three, that was considered a bit of a sorrow on our road. And everybody on the road settled at the same time. It was a little cul-de-sac and we all played out in the middle of it on our bikes. And yes, I was the youngest of five. So I was precocious. I was very chatty. And I was, I suppose, always looking for attention and getting it sometimes. So I was kind of treasured and poked at the same time.
Was there a sense of trying to get your voice to cut through, trying to make yourself heard?
Yeah, there are five interesting people in my generation of the family, and each with their own point of view. Actually, as I grew older, one of the things that used to annoy me was that my memory of events was never the official one. So if I said that happened, there were four people who were older than me who would say, no, you're wrong. That's not the way it happened. And I would say, no, that happened to me. So I know. And they, you know, so I wasn't the official keeper of records, for sure.
Had to become a writer then.
I had to become a writer and annoy them all. So the other thing about being the youngest in the family is that the pressure was off by the time it came to me. So my parents, my mother in particular, wanted to get the children into one profession or another and get them sorted and settled. But she'd sort of run out of energy and I wasn't really up for it. So there is some phrase which I haven't been able to find since, where every gentleman's family, the luxury is an artist. So I had the luxury of being an artist, and the family had the luxury and the terror of having an artist in the family.
Tell me a little bit more about your mother, Cora. You've said that you have a theory that writers all have mothers that are big figures in their lives.
People's mothers are big to them one way or the other, whether they talk about it or not. And maybe writers are better at admitting that. But yeah, my mother is 91. She grew up in Phibsborough in Dublin. And I think the most mythic thing about my mother is that she was born after her father died. So she was a magical event and a kind of perhaps a disaster as well as a wonderful happening. Her mother didn't know she was pregnant at the funeral, for example. So she was reared by a very literate, educated woman who was widowed with four children, very unexpectedly, by a man who died young. They were a very bookish family. My granny went to university, which is really mad. Very few women did that. So there was a very strong dynamic there about books, mm-hmm. about poverty, and about magic, maybe.
It's time to hear your second track today, Anne. What's it going to be?
This is a track from Tom Waits' Heart Attack and Vine, and it's Jersey Girl. This is a track that I listened to in my first years in college when I started going out with my husband, Martin.
Had no time for the corner boys, down in the street making all that noise. No one, no hoes on 8th Avenue, 'cause tonight I'm gonna be with you. 'Cause tonight I'm gonna take that ride 'cross to the Jersey side.
Jersey Girl, Tom Waits. Anne Enright, let's stay in your childhood for a little while. Is it true that you used to read a book a day?
When I was seven, I had read all the books in the children's section of the library, and I was agitating to get an adult ticket, which they sort of handed to me with a small smile and then let me loose around the stacks. I still remember how dark it felt, the green lino on the floor and these oak bookcases.
What did you find there?
So I would read, you know, Joyce or... I'm actually a bit embarrassed at the precocity of my reading. I don't know why. I bought my first copy of Ulysses when I was 14, and I read Lolita at far too early an age, and things like I shouldn't really have read and regret reading like Norman Mailer. Comprehension, as a result, was not a key value for me. Mm-hmm. It's like you don't have to understand it to love it.
What about school? You said you went to a good convent school.
I met a very posh English woman once and I told her I was educated by nuns, and she said, "And were they terribly sadistic?" I said, no, they were themselves. Ireland was a very religious place. I was trying to describe it to my daughter recently. She was saying, "Why did people have so many children?" And I said, "Well, they didn't have any contraception." She said, "Why didn't they have any contraception?" And I said, "Well, it wasn't sold. It was illegal." And she'd say, "Why?" And I said, "Well, because the church." And she said, "Why did people do what they said?" She just couldn't get her head around it. You go to confession and tell them. And she said, "Well, why did people go to confession?" And I said, "Because if you didn't, you would go to hell." And I had a similar conversation with my mother, actually, not too long ago. I said, "What was all that fuss?" And she said, "Well, you know, there was always hell." And there was always hell.
You've said that you were strongly committed not to be whatever a girl was when you were young. What do you mean by that?
A funny thing kicked in my teens, and I still don't get it. And it is that thing that girls have to be good. And it's not just about boyfriends or sexual behaviour. It's about your nails. And it's about looking after everyone. And I was very wary of the feeling of catastrophe that attended this. What is the catastrophe if you don't get an A? It's actually, there is no catastrophe. But that fear of being less than perfect, I found very onerous. And I found the whole, I mean, I suppose today you'd call it the gender thing, was a bit foreign to me. I do remember being very cross when people tried to limit what I wanted to have or get or be. I remember being very non-compliant, yeah.
Time for your third disc today, Anne. What's it going to be?
When I was 16, I finished school and I went off on a jaunt. I got a scholarship to Canada. There were 52 countries and 200 students on scholarship, and the money was just spilling. By my Irish standards, was just amazing. I remember the first question I asked is, "When is there hot water?" I came from a country where there wasn't always hot water, and the Canadians just laughed. Like, you know, when you turn on the tap, that's when there's hot water. There was community involvement and lots of hiking through forests and stuff. It was really great. I had actually finished school, so I didn't need my exams. So this is Case of You by Joni Mitchell, which comes from that time.
Just before our love got lost, you said, "I am as constant as a northern star." And I said, "Constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar." Back of a cartoon coaster in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada.
A Case of You by Joni Mitchell, taking you back to Canada, Anne Enright. You moved there for 2 years with your scholarship at just 16. How did you feel about leaving home?
People sometimes say, "Well, you're not afraid." And I didn't really know what I should be afraid of. Partly because we used to go off on cycling holidays and things at the age of 13 that children wouldn't do now. So going off was an adventure. It was an amazing time for, I think, most of the people who were there. But most distinctively for me was I got a great teacher, my English teacher, Theo. And I did show Theo my ghastly poetry.
How was the feedback?
Well, he said, "Yes, it's so mortifying, isn't it?" And to have that articulated and out in the air, that was a good move already. But in our first class, he taught a poem by Keats called La Belle Dame sans Merci. And there's a rude line in Keats, which was, she looked at me as we did love and made sweet moan. And Theo said, well, we all know what that means. I was 16 and I was absolutely furious. I went up to him afterwards. I said, you have ruined, besmirched a great poem and a great poet for me. And he looked at me like, OK, we've got a live one, basically. But I mean, I think about it sometimes. I was a really moral little miss.
Did you enjoy the freedom that your trip abroad brought?
Yeah, I met people there who were so different from me. I remember the first conversation I had with this fellow student who didn't believe in God, the first person I met who didn't believe in God. He was a very tall Dutch man who also, as part of this conversation, overshared the information that he and his family were often naked in in the same space. So I couldn't deal with any of that.
I mean, really. How did that go down with you? You described yourself as quite a moral kind of 16-year-old.
I just thought he should really believe in God and put his clothes on and and that would make us all a lot happier. So that mindset, that was new. Mm. So you're so unthinking when you're growing up. So it was a real lesson in diversity.
What did you miss about home and Ireland in the late 70s?
The month I left Ireland, the Pope came to visit. So I missed the Pope.
Were you sorry to miss the Pope?
I wasn't sorry to miss the Pope. I was by that time, although quite religious, I wasn't a Catholic. I was a non-Catholic. But I got letters from my school friends, just ecstatic with the Pope. And I thought, this is kind of mad. But it made me feel, yes, for 2 seconds, hugely lonely that I hadn't missed that. And then the next thing I missed was the Debs dance, which is the dance after school. And people were going off with boys that I knew. And that was when it really hit me and I had a big cry. And after that, I was grand.
Let's have some more music. It's time for your fourth disc. What's it going to be?
This is Then You'll Remember Me. It's sung by Dave Dannon and it comes from The Bohemian Girl. This song was actually James Joyce's second favourite song. I have no idea what his first favourite was. He was an accomplished tenor, Joyce. I heard it when I was a teenager and then it disappeared. You know, it's one of those things. We had it on vinyl and I couldn't find it on Spotify. So when I finally landed on it, I was delighted.
There may perhaps in such a scene some recollection be of times that have as happy.
Then You'll Remember Me by Dave Dannon. You came home from Canada, Anne Enright, and attended Trinity College in Dublin, reading English and philosophy. And while you were there, you signed up with the Players Theatre. Were you keen to act?
It was what I did in my first week when I was there. I sported at the time a poncho. You'd be glad to
talk
hear.
Talk me through the poncho.
The poncho was not a Mexican poncho. It was a poncho I had made myself.
Even better.
From a homespun blanket that I had bought in Kilkenny Design. And I went up to the table in Freshers Week for Players and with a flourish of my poncho, I signed the form.
You met your husband Martin there. He directed you?
He did. He directed me. He tried to direct me and has failed ever since. Actually, now I can overshare and say that I auditioned for Martin in September or October of that year. And the thing he wrote down on the sheet, his notes from the audition, he said, bingo, exclamation mark.
Prophetic.
Prophetic it was, yeah.
You acted for a year after college. What did that give you?
Yeah, I was a professional actress for at least half a year. It gave me the super rush of being unprepared and going on stage with the set still sticky with paint and no one knowing their lines. It's a dream. And it kind of stayed with me in a dreamscape for years afterwards.
Is that moment of improvisation, not knowing where you're going, a creative place to be for you then?
Well, improvisation is a brilliant skill. To know that you don't need a safety net is fantastic. When you're making up a story or whether you're working voices, and I often, as a writer, I'm working somebody's voice, the narrator's voice or the dialogue or whatever. And so theatre and acting is a really good preparation for all of that.
How did you start writing in earnest?
I suppose I started writing in the theatre. I had my ghastly poems and then I was writing a few monologues. And then when I was 21, my siblings bought me a typewriter for my birthday. And I sort of banged out, rattled out. It was on a little metal table in the bedroom, which was quite cold. And I would sit there and pound out these little vignettes, a couple of plays.
And the implement itself is significant for you, isn't it? You suit a typewriter, suit a keyboard.
I do, yeah. I find when I write longhand, it's a bit too lady. I do lady writing, on and on it goes with lots of flourishes. And, you know, I need the crispness. I need the sharpness of the keyboard.
Let's take a break for some music. What are we going to hear next?
Ah, this is a song that my husband plays. Sometimes after dinner he picks up the guitar and I know he's feeling feisty if it's this song by Johnny Cash.
There's a man going round taking names and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around.
Johnny Cash and The Man Comes Around. So, Anne Enright, you decided to focus on your writing and chose a creative writing course at UEA. It was led by Angela Carter and Malcolm Bradbury, no less, but you said that there was no shaft of light and inspiration didn't strike. Why?
Yeah, I sailed off on the ferry, literally, with my typewriter and a suitcase and arrived at UEA. And Angela Carter was there. There was a workshop. There were nine of us. Really good, nice people were there. But I failed and failed again, really. I had a huge sense of myself as a writer, but I had no huge sense of what I wanted to write about. So I sat in a breeze block room in Waveney Terrace in the University of East Anglia and unwrote my great book, which was hugely overambitious. And I'd sit up all night and lose words. And so it spiraled down for me. It wasn't good, the work. I couldn't produce it. Mm-hmm. And I think by Easter, I was not in a great place. But I came home and I wrote three stories in a row and they got published by Faber. It was amazing. It's really odd.
What made the difference, do you think?
Well, I was writing short stories. They were small and I could do them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the novel I had planned was set in three different centuries, in three different languages, by the way. Oh, stop. I mean, come on. So I was doing something I could do.
In 1987, you joined RTE as a producer of a late night show called Nighthawks while continuing to write short stories at weekends. Was it running on adrenaline? Live TV can be quite an adrenal experience.
It is apparently more adrenalizing than going over the top in World War One, though how they measured that, I don't know. And we did it over and over again. So, I mean, yes, you do run out of adrenaline after, you know, year two. Mm-hmm. It was hard. We were young and we were feisty and unknowing. And I do think that the media takes people like that and uses their creativity and says, go for it. So you burn out after 3 or 4 years. But I was glad that I'd been in the world. And it was really interesting to see ambition at work and the mystery that was management. All of those things. It's better to know them than not to know them, perhaps.
Mm. You burned out, though. How bad was it?
Oh, it was pretty bad, all right. I was high functioning. I suppose increasingly angry. And then one day, oof, gone, bang.
What happened?
I was booked into a facility and I sat on the bed and I couldn't unbutton my shirt. Just wiped, absolutely wiped. And I don't know how long I spent there, actually. Yeah. 2 or 3 weeks, something like that.
How did you find your way back?
With difficulty, thank you for asking. No, how did I find my way back? Well, I took the meds and I spent 6 months in a kind of numb enough state. But And I felt as though I had lost something for a while, actually, that a room had been closed in my mind, that I wouldn't be able to open that door again. And I think that was probably the medication. Then I kind of came off the meds and made decisions about my life. One of them was to leave broadcasting, and the other was to earn enough money to get a flat where I could live and get married. But the real decision was to write.
Let's have some more music. What are we going
to
hear?
This is a track by Laurie Anderson, which takes me back to those broadcasting days, and it's Hiawatha from Strange Angels.
And I said, Ella, operator, get me Memphis, Tennessee. And she said, I know who you're trying to call, darling, and he's not home, he's been away. But you can hear him on the air. He's a whole nother world. Yeah, this is your country station. And honey, this next one for you.
Laurie Anderson and Hiawatha. So Anne Enright, the plan, one part of the plan was to get married. You married Martin in 1991. He's your first reader when you write.
He is actually my first listener.
So you read to him?
Yeah, I won't let him read it. And he says, no, let me read it. And I say, no, you have to listen to it. And so we have a little squabble.
What's the difference?
Well, it's who controls it is the difference, I suppose. And I know something's running well for me when I want to read it out to Martin.
Does he give you feedback?
He does give me feedback. He has about 50 different kinds of silence now. And
are you keenly attuned to them? I get
I'm keenly attuned to all of them. Mm. So I can tell if it's an approving silence or a very, very excited and delighted silence, or kind of what the hell was that sort of silence? Or maybe.
Your fourth novel, The Gathering, was published in 2007 and it won the Booker Prize. That brings money, of course, £50,000 and global recognition. How did it affect you personally?
Well, it didn't affect me at all for a while. It seemed to affect everyone around me in the most hilarious sort of way or alarming sort of way.
What happened?
So, well, I was the calm centre of a lot of publishing agitation suddenly. People change within the industry and their attitude to you shifts. So you're walking through a different world, interestingly. Quite odd.
What was new that you were encountering?
I have a great sort of yearning for the privacy of the book. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about reading is it's just you and the page, you know. It's not a communal experience, but this was a crowd experience. And it took me a while to get back to the individual reader. It didn't make people necessarily happy. You winning a prize.
Who wasn't happy?
Who wasn't happy? Who wasn't? Everyone who thought they should have won the prize, they were unhappy. Yeah, particularly it has to be said the guys were made unhappy. You know, I think it's true that if a woman does well, that men can be sort of somehow personally insulted by their success, even though it's not really about them at all.
Did you experience that?
Well, it took me a while to figure out what was going on in a couple of cases. All right, yeah. But you get little stings and barbs and you think, oh, what's his problem? Oh yeah, okay. So it was something you had done to them. It's really interesting when what is somehow you're sprinkled with fairy dust or something. It's quite a magical experience. So it brings out quite infantile, quite irrational stuff. And that's interesting to see. You're the centre, briefly, thank God, of a lot of people's projections.
Let's have some more music. It's your seventh disc, Anne Enright. What are we going to hear and why?
We're going to hear the wonderful Leonard Cohen, that writer of music. Actually, when I was 13, my appalling siblings, gave me a book of poetry by Leonard Cohen as a birthday present. It was called Flowers for Hitler. I don't know what that means about what I was like at 13. I suppose I was a bit of a goth, but it was a dark choice, don't you think?
Well, my friends are gone and my hair is grey. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming on. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song.
Leonard Cohen and Tower of Song. Anne Enright, you wrote not long ago that I started to ask myself in middle age, who was I trying to annoy? Isn't that just the same as trying to please them? I wonder what answer you arrived at.
Yeah, well, I thought about this a lot after my father died, how easy and gentle the sense of his authority had been all through my life and how much he trusted me in all my various ventures and adventures. And that isn't necessarily what you get from other male authorities, which can be much more restrictive. So it was a sense of getting over that mythic, real or otherwise, sense of someone who is going to judge you, whether it's the makers of the canon or the high-minded academics or whoever is in charge of what's right now and what's important now. So I was negotiating with a sense of importance. And because I'm naturally quite transgressive and undermining of senses of importance, I was never going to really win that game, nor should I have been playing it at all, really, because creativity is not authoritarian. It's about anti-authoritarian movement and change.
And have you come out of the other side of that?
Well, I'm standing on my own 2 feet. I feel planted. I feel more or less secure in my creative process. But, you know, I always, always knew that I was going to write. So I was always safe because I had the page.
Just one more disc from you, Anne Enright. This is your final choice today. What's it going to be?
This is Suave, Sia il Vento from Così fan tutti by Mozart. It's a sublime trio. They're waving off a ship, waving goodbye to their lovers who are actually not on the ship. They're standing there beside them. So it's a kind of joke goodbye. And as a joke goodbye, I think it's perfect for a funeral, perhaps even my own, as I sail off down the aisle.
Part of Suave Sia il Vento from Mozart's Così fan tutti, sung by Elisabeth Schwarzkopf, Walter Berry and Christa Ludwig, with the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Carl Böhm. Anne Enright, it's a cruel thing, I think, to limit someone with your appetite for books to just three, but I'm afraid that that is very much the deal on this programme. We'll give you the complete works of Shakespeare, the Bible and a book of your choice. What would you like to take with you?
I think I'll have to take the Proust, In Search of Lost Time, as it's now translated. If I was, you know, a very long time on the desert island, I could have a parallel text with the French on one side and the English on the other, and I could work up my French.
It's yours. You can also take a luxury item to help you pass the time more enjoyably. What do you fancy?
I'd like some really high thread count cotton sheets, please.
OK.
Yeah, dense, cold, cold cotton. It has to be over 600 or nothing.
Don't worry, they're yours. And if you had to save just one of your 8 tracks from being washed away in the surf, which would it be?
I think it has to be the Mozart. He's sublime.
Anne Enright, thank you so much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Anne. If you'd like to hear more from other writers who've been cast away, you'll find them on BBC Sounds or via the Desert Island Discs website. Among them are Ali Smith, Julie Cooper, Jan Morris, Peter Ackroyd, Vikram Seth and Kate Atkinson. In 2016, Kirsty Young cast away Anne's fellow Irish novelist, Colm Tobin.
I can write anywhere as long as there's a blank wall in front of me, no great view, and a pretty uncomfortable chair. But I've been working a lot recently in Wexford, in the house you mentioned, in the place where we went every summer in the years before my father died. And it's funny, you know, when I'm going down to the Strand, the smell is the same smell. Harvested fields, clover, but even animals, because we were from the town. So it's going right back into the past, which means I'm getting images. And even if I'm not writing directly about it, it's quite emotional, even being there.
Productive writing is such a discipline. You're not somebody who'll take a long lunch.
I think the big thing is never do lunch. You know, you need a lot of silence and time on your own. Things happen of their own accord, but only if you give them, I suppose, peace. Music can be helpful, but not while you're working.
Is it true that you once told a creative writing class that you have to be a monster to write?
Yeah, I meant that, you know, stop worrying about your grandmother's feelings, your mother's feelings, your girlfriend's feelings or your own feelings. Your job is to get the thing down. And if you have to use something that belongs to you or to somebody else, write it down. But don't be saying, when my Auntie Mary finally dies, I'll be able to write the most wonderful story. Write it now and tell your Auntie Mary you're just sorry, but you've told a story that is really quite private and belongs to her. But now it's going to be published and it's coming out next week.
Have you had to do that with people in your own family?
Yes, certainly with my mother. She's very funny about her. It was an early story. There was a lot of children in the house, so she would get all the knives and forks and put them in the middle of the table and just take what you needed. Mm. I put that into a story as an image of a mother who wasn't very tidy and good with housekeeping. And she said, well, wasn't that awful the way you put it into the story? If I'd known that, I would have set the table properly every day.
Colm Tobin speaking to Kirsty in 2016. Next time, I'll be casting away the first woman to be Master of Jesus College, Cambridge, Sunita Alain. I do hope you'll join us then.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Anna Delvey was due to inherit $67 million.
I'm so excited about what the future holds.
She secured huge investments for a project in New York.
She was very confident in her words.
And yet, it was all a lie.
She's a con artist.
Join journalist Vicky Baker as she delves into a real-life scandal.
We'll mix drama with documentary to tell the story of Anna Delvey's rise and fall.
Fake Heiress, a new six-part podcast on BBC Sounds.
I was watching this whole thing happen thinking it can't be true.
Download the free app to listen.